Each man should frame life so that at some future hour, fact and his dreaming meet.
It's beautiful.
Victor Hugo. I found this other one by Jim Morrison of The Doors.
Yes.
About the body. The body tries to tell the truth, but it's usually too battered with rules to be heard and bound with pretenses so that it can hardly move. We cripple ourselves with lies.
Wow.
Wow.
Really profound.
Yeah. Well, shall we get rolling? I thought we would do the review first and then jump into the material, because one of the things about this last section is putting it in context. It kind of seems to come out of nowhere, but it really does follow the line. So I will take down our FCAN mandala for a second. That's later.
Is Carol going to be
Carol's not?
Oh, she's not coming. That's right. She said she couldn't make it. No.
I did bring her picture of the matrix for her comments. Read those to you.
We started off, this is just a quick review of the whole spiel. Chapter one, we had two definitions of projection. When you put something inside out, and when you, that's sort of a personal look at it. The other look at it is a disturbance in the archaic identity between subject and object. So the idea there is you don't really make projections. Projection is the original state, and the business of life is withdrawing it. She talked about five steps in withdrawing the projection. First, there's a projected state and a differentiation. When you realize the situation or the person or the event isn't what you thought it was, and you're left perplexed. And then the third step is morally evaluating it. And the fourth step is saying, well, that was an illusion. Morning. And the fifth step is seeing it as a psychological resistance. We will halt while you bring in your bag of riches.
My bag of riches.
Rearrange.
I'm really classy. I don't know what to do this morning. I dropped two things since I've been here. Starbucks coffee cake is
really good.
Mm. Very good. Wow, that's beautiful. Mm. Wow.
Dive in, folks. We'll take a pause. We'll take a double pause.
It comes with chips, too.
Oh. Shall I get maybe another little table, maybe? Mm. Is there room?
We can arrange.
We can manage.
Lebanese yogurt, olives, and some feta cheese. That has a Arab spice on it called za'atar, which is a combination of thyme and sumac.
Mmm!
Pine
nuts. Pine nuts and sesame oil.
Mmm!
So, stuff.
Mmm!
This way.
It's light and yet substantial.
Yeah, it's kind of a breakfast food, actually. I mean, put this on pita bread in the morning. Not as fancy as this, but with tomatoes and cucumber and olives and things like that.
Wow.
It's kind of healthy.
That's delicious.
Oh, and then I brought show and tell.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
cars are late. I had to return a rental car this morning.
You got some food like that. You can come.
Anytime.
That's
my ticket to ride.
Then.
Yeah, I'll be back.
Oh my gosh, how is it that way? No wonder you're staying in shape. Don't go.
My library in there.
Pulls out his car and.
My wife complains about this coat all the time.
We're still waiting for the rabbit.
Still looking for it.
Isn't there somewhere?
Yeah.
That's what we need, a fold-up car.
Yeah.
You know, if you have your car folded up, put it in your pocket. They have those fold-up bike.
Mm-hmm.
You see those?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they take those on the boats and do that shit. Yeah. People. And they're small, real small tires. I go to the grocery store. That is really easy.
That's excellent, John. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that we give ourselves a sitting ovation.
How is Lebanese yogurt different from, say, Greek?
You know, they're pretty close. It's a little, it's not the Greek yogurt. It has an almost custard-like consistency. Mm-hmm. The Lebanese yogurt is a thicker. You can make it yourself. Just take regular store-bought yogurt, put it in a cheesecloth,
right.
Drain it overnight. Yeah.
Make Greek yogurt.
Yeah, and so it's just that if you ask a Lebanese, Greek yogurt, they'll just say it's Lebanese yogurt. Different names, so you can get in the store. It usually is under the name Laban or something like that. But she put some regular yogurt in there to kind of thin it out just a little for different people. They like a lot of sour flavors.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. Lots of my mom, lots of yogurt paste dishes.
Mm. What's their main source of protein? Is it beans?
Probably that and fish, because
mm-hmm.
they're right there on the a lot of fish.
That's Mediterranean, right?
Yeah.
They don't eat lamb. They eat
a lot of lamb. That's another source of protein, but more like they're eating a lot of fish and of course kebab. Mm-hmm. And there's some beef too.
I think I can live on fish. So. Okay,
shall we try to push on? So, two definitions, five steps. This is still chapter one. A typical image of projection in dreams is a projectile, bullets, arrows. And she talks a little bit about how do you know if you have a dream, whether that dream is about a projection or about reality. Basic answer is you don't. You try it, either way. Then she talked about projection in religion, projection in science, that's chapter 3, and that was something we'll come back to today. So remember, she was saying things like, well, all these images that we have in science, the circular model of the atom, which was developed before we could see orbits, comes out of these archetypal images. The sphere, which was an image of God, particles of light, which was an image of God, and energy, which was attributed to shamans and big people. So she's saying all these images that we work in science existed in the context first. Then she talked about the collective unconscious as what is projected. That was chapter 4. In chapter 5, 6, and 7, She talked about demons as portraits of what we project. There are evil demons, that was the shadow. There are mediating demons, that's the anima and animus. And then there are companions or guides, which would represent self. Now, moving into where we are in chapter 8, she started talking about, okay, that's what projection is. What does it mean to withdraw them? And then she talked about the idea that what we do is we recollect ourselves, hence the title of the book, in these projections. And a classic image for this process is the eye in dreams. And then we ended up in chapter 9, started off with what is projected, and then withdrawing projections, and now this last chapter is, so what do you get if you withdraw them? And that's where we are. And that is the self. And we stopped at 186. Did all sound okay? Quick survey of the book. I just put up here a very brief outline of what we'll be doing, because it's a little tedious. We're going to be talking about four types of mirroring, where the self mirrors the ego. And that is that in our dreams, we see parts of ourselves, so that something in us is showing us who we are. And that behind all those dream images for her is the self. Then another thing we'll talk about is the ego mirrors the self. Namely, what we try to do is understand these images and then put them into reality so that our work makes our life a reflection of what the self is. And then, this gets a little theoretical, but I think very interesting, how the collective unconscious mirrors matter. And that's just what I said earlier, that in our psyche we have the forms, the same forms that matter uses in its structure. The mandala, the point, and so on. And then this is about synchronicity, how matter mirrors the collective unconscious. How is it that synchronistic events are the same as a dream? And that the psychic world is not only inner, it's also outer. And this being one of Jung's later ideas.
And you said synchronistic events are the same as a dream.
Right. Okay. Right. That the psyche is both internal and external. So we can say that the dreams mirror us, but we can also say that matter mirrors us. I mean, I just saw one this week. You just sit there and go, holy smokes. A woman who has experience and is at a point in life where she really should start writing about her experiences in a professional framework. Didn't want to go through the hassle of it. And dreamt that somebody she knew in her profession was giving a lecture at a big conference. And so that was pretty untypical of this individual. And so she thought, well, that's encouraging me to write. Next day she got a brochure from that conference, and that person is indeed presenting at that conference. See, well, where does that come from? Mm-hmm. That kind of a thing, where the inner world and the outer world converge. And that really made an impression that it's, you know, if her friend can do it, she can do it too.
And you had said, you know, World War I and II was an eruption of the new God image trying to come through.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just thinking that World War I and II, it would be a mirror of the inner God and the collective.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a good point. History, in a way, is our mirror. Okay. Well, some of this we've already done, and so I think we don't have to dwell on everything, but just go through the main points. The first page, 186, is just an introduction, and then on 187, at the top paragraph, she just lists what I put up there. Four mirror relations, mirroring the ego by the self, the mirroring of the self by the ego, the mirroring of matter by the collective unconscious, and the possible mirroring of the latter in matter. So on that page, what she's just bringing our attention to is that these dream images show us a portrait as we're seeing from the self. We may not see the self seeing us, but each dream image is a reflection of our deeper truth, and but seen by whom? By the self. And then as that work evolves, that self does show up, seeing us, and that would be dreams of eyes, EYE. And I think it must be such a pressure on us now. I don't watch TV, but I do know, aware that all these reality shows, you know, there's the camera, and that's the eye. There's a terrific need to be seen. And I think its deeper meaning is to be seen by an other that is inside. But that's a lot of work, so one settles for being seen by the outside. Then she goes into the second point, that the not only does the ego mirror, not only does the self mirror the ego, but the ego mirrors the self. And I think the best example of that is the dream that she tells of Jung's on page 188, about the middle of the page, where he sees a yogi meditating, and he thinks he's the projection of Jung, but then he realizes Jung is the projection of him. Of him, the yogi. And I think that's just a beautiful... And then when the yogi wakes up, Jung will die. Did she say that in there? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's in memories, the mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. But just this idea that we are the outward manifestation of a deeper reality. And we're not in a haphazard world totally. And, yeah.
After reading this, it made more sense. Jung's statement that God needs us. We need God, but God needs us to develop.
You're right. I mean, that's so important.
And this just made that more.
Mm-hmm.
More clearly.
Yeah, that's the way I felt too. To realize I am an exponent of something else. And what we're trying to do in our dream work, sooner or later, is get to ask, what does that something else want me to be an exponent of?
Well, I mean, in the fact that we help the self to see itself. In Job, I mean, the big thing was he saw Yahweh for what he was.
Yeah.
Which helped Yahweh become more conscious. That mirroring, I guess, is just really the key to it.
It's the key. Yeah. I don't know why she wrote this chapter, but, you know, if you listen to contemporary neo-Freudian psychology, it's all about mirroring. And for them, it's all about the mother doesn't mirror the child. So I wonder if she has a subtext here. There's a lot more to it than that. It's really, it's not just a personalistic issue. It's a transpersonal issue.
Yeah, I mean, because when she explained on 188, she preferred to use the word mirroring. It's because it's not just a regular projection.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's not just an automatic thing, it takes reflection. That's what I got out of that.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's exactly right.
But it's not that sounds artificial, what you're saying in Freudian.
I feel it. I've never been able to accept that. So it really has informed a lot of therapeutic style, because in their view, the mother's lack of mirroring means the therapist has to mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do you do with your negative emotions? What do you do when you don't feel like mirroring? That's the problem I'm left with. And I think it's totally false. So they end up not dealing with any negative emotions on the part of the therapist, because that's bad. Then you're the bad mother. But mothers are both loving and critical. Even healthy mothers say no. Yeah. Just a thought.
When you describe what Von Franz did to you and
Daryl.
But you said it was with a sense of humor and with the intent. You knew the intent behind it was that you developed.
Right.
Not that it's just criticism to embarrass.
Right.
Whatever. But it was the intent was to help you develop.
And what was so odd?
See your larger.
That's exactly the point. What is so odd is it felt like a compliment. I didn't, and I don't think Daryl did either. I don't know how much this guy was a doctoral dissertation. But it's like, it's not, there's something wrong with you, it's there's something right with you, you're not developing, and I know it's there. She could be very critical, but it was never belittling or putting down. It was strangely supportive. That was what was one of the unique things about her.
That sounds what's going on here, if it's done with the right intent.
Yeah, right.
You go with self thing.
Mm-hmm. If you want to put it in that language, I think neo-Freudian stuff mirrors the ego, and she's talking about mirroring the self. Mm-hmm. If you mirror the self, the ego, if the ego is out of kilter with the self, it has to be criticized. But never put down. We've lost that. I watch these teachers over at Butler. They have to be positive. If they're not positive with the students, give them a bad recommendation or bad evaluation, and their salary is tied to the student's evaluation. So everything is positive. It's twisted. Do you? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think we just don't know how to do the other. I don't think we know how to do what Von Franz did in the same spirit.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, the way I framed it is she was an example of the opposites united. So, I mean, I think in the normal person like ourselves, where they're not united, you're either critical or you're supportive. Mm-hmm. And she had the two together. And I think Jung must have had two.
I think people who are individuated as well can do that.
Can do that.
Because
yeah.
There's still themselves, so there's no supposition that I'm better than you because I'm better than you.
There is no supposition that I'm better than you.
Right. It's not out of power.
It's not out of power. No.
Yeah, I always think when you show this, Molière was Jung's shadow.
Voltaire.
Or Voltaire. But anyway, you had given us that handout with him. And one of the things the priest said at his deathbed was, Do you regret your sin? Yes, especially those I haven't.
Yeah, right.
It's a good image.
Yeah.
How he did that to himself, in that scenario. But it's always looking for, I think that's what Jung was in, when Franz was so brilliant at, is looking for that. What is the gold in there to be extracted?
Apropos priest, I'm just reading this book, so I'm kind of thrilled to go back to that time in my life. But I don't know whether it's apocryphal or not, but one of the articles claims that as a youngster, 10 or 11, Von Franz was filled with anti-religious questioning. And so her parents sent her to a priest. And by the end of the year's discussion, the priest left the priesthood. I think 10 or 11. I don't know whether it's true or whether it's apocryphal, but
right.
that's in there.
Who's therapy too?
Well, it's like in the movie. Amadeus, remember, he's confessing to the priest, and by the end of the interview, the priest's sitting there, just overwhelmed with everything. He couldn't handle it. Well, did you follow the dream on 180? I don't know if we need to go through it, but it's a very important dream, 188. Is that okay, or should we go through that? Is it okay? Well, it's a dream of... apparently a PK, a preacher's kid, and he's being pursued by somebody of a divine significance, and when he finally turns around, he sees that the pursuer is himself. Suggesting, well, I think that's why this is so important, suggesting that the sacred thing, you see, in the center of the mandala used to be the image of God. Look at any mandala. It's in the Christian frame, it's Jesus Christ or Mary or something like that. And if you look at non-Christian mandalas, I think 99% of the time was at the center of some image of the sacred mountain, you know, or the sacred pool, something sacred. But here it's the mirror. That's why I think it's so important. And revitalizing our understanding of what God is. Not that we are God, but that our inner process is much more religious than we realize. I don't know whether that's supposed to be Afghan, John. We were talking, this is from Sandy's family heritage. And I also read in here that Montfort said, you know, before she died, which was way before the collision between Christianity and Islam, that the task for the future would be the synthesis of Christianity and Islam. And I don't know whether they have that idea, maybe in the mystical tradition, that the Sufis...
In fact, I was just thinking, as you were talking, of the Sufi poet Kabir, and they have shrines to him, and in the altar of the shrine to him is nothing.
Well, that's close. Yeah. That's very close.
I was just thinking that.
And along this line, too, in this book, they report a dream of one of Franz, which I thought was just amazing. Very short, that she witnessed that a church had to be destroyed so that on that spot a tree could be planted.
Mm.
So I think that's where we are. And that's another way of saying what's going on here in these first couple of sections. That our development becomes the reflection of the divine. Worship is becoming who you are. Worship isn't going to church. Now, the next section is something we've already done, pretty much, when we talked about the different shapes that pre-exist in the psyche that have given rise to scientific theories. Meaning that the psyche and matter share a similar structure. I don't know who came up with that idea first. I know Pauli talked a lot like that. You know, how did these guys develop the idea that that the electron ring was a circle? Now, I think now we can photograph it more or less. But in those days, all they were working with were, you know, bands of light. You're aware of that origin of quantum mechanics. They were looking at, if you take a prism and hold it up to sunlight, right, you get a rainbow. But if you hold it up to the light of a pure element, like, I don't know exactly what they would use, say, I guess neon, pure neon, or something like that, that's electrified and glows, the light comes out in very specific bands, and there's nothing in between. There's a red, and then there's a space, and then there'll be maybe a blue-violet, and then a space, and then a green. There's no smooth continuum. And they couldn't figure out why was light like that. And that then led to quantum mechanics, in which they developed this idea of electrons spinning and then jumping, you know, in orbit. But they did that before they could see. So the idea is, they're these thought models which give rise to scientific theories are originally in us. And because matter and psyche share these similar patterns, there is a mirroring relationship. That's about it. We kind of did that. That's all she's doing in the next section. Okay? So that takes us to 190. And synchronicity. This, I think, is the some of the new thinking. So go to the last paragraph from 190. Working with the idea that there is a mirror relationship between matter and the psyche, she says, look at the italicized part there, material events in the external world would have to be regarded as statements about conditions in the objective psyche. Like that woman's thinking about writing, has a dream of somebody who is writing, that gives her support, and then she sees that fact in the outer world, which gives her even more support. And she's a bit of a rationalist, so it shocked her.
So when the atomic bomb went off, then something went off in the psyche.
I have a thought about that. What do you know about the history of culture? See, when was bomb 19?
47?
Or 44, yeah. Mm-hmm. 45, I think.
45, yeah.
You know what else was discovered in whatever year the bomb went off, 44, 45. There was a momentous psychological event. Well, that was later.
The Kinsey Report?
Well, you're going in the right direction. Nag Hammadi, the Gnostic Gospels were discovered, in which we have the first written testament of Sophia. Nag Hammadi. It's a town in Egypt, and it's an amazing story. A couple of guys, I think, were just spelunking in caves. Nag Hammadi is what, northern Egypt, I think? Spelunking around some caves and found this huge cache of scrolls. And they didn't even know what they were. They were used as, really, I think, as toilet paper, some of them, or as stuffing in houses. And they finally realized these are documents from time of Christ. And they have since all been, you know, collated, treasured, published. And a codex was named for Jung. It was called the Jung Codex. I don't know whatever happened to it. They're all in museums somewhere now, under preserved conditions. But that's the original record of those people who believed that God's girlfriend was Sophia. So you weren't too far off with Kinsey Report. And Sophia is sexual. She's no virgin. And she's both sexual and spiritual. So that split between the spirit and the body doesn't exist in Sophia. So I think that's amazing, in a way, that text would appear the same year, bringing that archetype, which is so important. And another dream that they tell of von Franz told somebody, was that she dreamt that Jung and the Black Madonna were working to save the world. Same thing. And it's the union of spirit and matter. Seeing matter as sacred, which is where we are. You know, this is a thought way of discussing that same thing. She doesn't talk about the body, but it could be the same. As you read from Jim Morrison, the body is a purveyor of knowledge, just as synchronicities are.
There's a wonderful piece of, I think it's
piece, poem, about the body. But he refers to the body as like a clay jug. Or he says, in this clay jug are canyons and pine mountains and the maker of canyons and pine mountains. All seven oceans are inside and hundreds and millions of stars.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's it. That may have something to do with whether we survive or not. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. I think she quotes Jung, but I think we know that kind of, we know that already. So 191, nothing new. She's just giving us different phrasings of this basic idea that outer events occur simultaneously inside the psyche and reach consciousness by the usual pathways of inner perception. However, it is not always possible to determine whether a primary inner process is accompanied by an outer one or whether, conversely, a primary outer event is being reflected in a secondary inner process. I remember a tragic situation of a woman who was a twin sister, was raped. 2 days later, her sister was raped in a town 200 miles away. Now, what's going on? See what I'm saying? As if something is constellated in both those people. In that family. So we never know, do outer events cause the inner, or do inner events have something to do with outer? Okay, so the mirroring of matter and mirroring in matter of the psyche. And I think that goes over to 193. And what she's just doing now is circling around this basic idea from different perspectives. And on 193, she brings in the idea of absolute knowledge, which is you can't really express this without sounding stupid, but you could say, you know, how was it that that magazine appeared in that woman's lap when she needed a confirmation of her dream? If you twist your thinking to be on the side of the synchronistic event, it's as if these events know what's going on. I know that's anthropomorphic thinking, but still, that there's somehow there's an intelligence beyond us. And that's what Jung called absolute knowledge. But we've done this before, so.
Well, it's like as if World War I, too, gave birth to the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the impetus behind that, wasn't it? The scientists studying that. Oppenheimer and those guys.
You lost me.
That they were finding a way to end the war by trying to find this super bomb that was.
I see.
Well, I don't know. I was just playing around with that.
Well, there's an irony there. That's maybe what you're picking up. That they thought they were trying to produce peace, but in fact, they made the world very dangerous. And I know Niels Bohr went to Churchill to beg him to share the secrets with the Russians to stop the space, to stop the race. Churchill wouldn't hear it. How is that possible? Now, those of you who did number and time will remember this discussion. So over to 194. How is it possible that the psyche and the material world can exist in a way that allows synchronicity to be possible? Excuse me, possible. Her idea is number. I've never totally been able to get that. I'm not sure that's the answer, but it's worth considering that because matter has a numerical structure. The regularity of radioactive decay, for example, or the just so character of the relationship between electron rings, for example. Because that's numerically structured, and because meaning is numerically structured. In other words, when you're living a meaningful life, you realize, well, I did this first, I did this second, I did this third, and there's a relation. When you don't see the relationship between events, which you could describe 1, 2, 3, you feel you're living a meaningless life. Chaos is meaninglessness. Order is felt to be meaningful, and that's a numerical. That's designated by a numerical sequence. So she's saying, I think that's how matter and the psyche are connected. I don't know. It's a thought. You can chew on it. But that's what she's saying. 194. 195. And it is true, I think, that one of the things Jung brings to psychology is the unconscious is not chaos. With Freud, it's chaos. And for Jung, there is an order. There is an inborn ordering factor which leads you through the various stages of your life.
It's sort of like going through a cafeteria, the unconscious, and you're picking up.
Yeah, and if first you get the dessert, and second you get a dessert, and third you get a dessert, and fourth you get a candy bar, you're probably going to have a shitty meal. But if you get the right foods in the right sequence, then you're more likely to have a healthy meal. And so the idea is that how important sequence is to our idea of being. And sequence is also, it's a mathematical concept. That's what you did a number in time for. That's 200 murderous pages. Let's see. Well, a couple of just details in 195. People ask me this often. Do synchronistic events occur all the time and we don't know it? Or do they just occur at specific moments? She raises that question on 195 and says, we don't know. I say no. I'm always suspicious when I speak to New Age people how they're always having synchronicity. And they're just oblivious to the shadow. So, take a bit. I think they're rare. I'd say if you're having more than one a month, you might be something wrong with you. I say it somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but they don't happen often. But when they do, it's important to take notice.
There has to be an observer who can observe that and read the meaning
right.
In order for it to be real. I
mean, yeah.
If you say hello in the forest, you know, the idea is if nobody hears it,
right?
Did it really happen?
Exactly.
But, I mean, like I thought that her example of the Tao, the princess.
Yes. Where's that, Jane? 198. No.
Well, she talks about it again on 194, where events like the appearance of this 1, 2, 3 paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Events like the appearance of the volcano, an analogy with the psychic condition of the Empress, when the mountain came up and the Empress was ruling. Belong to those special occasions or cases. But there has to be an observer in a position to recognize the meaning of the equivalence of the two events. So I think probably, you know, there's probably synchronistic things going on a lot, but unless there's a person who can, who's conscious enough to see that there is a meaning between the two.
Yeah, that for sure.
But also you can get people that are like the queen and the princess who everything is synchronistic to what they believe. Therefore, it's It just rationalizes their own ego position. Yep. Everything.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, you should add the writing. The Tao meaning.
Right. Yeah.
Well, not the ego.
I think when you find people who everything all the time is synchronistic to what they believe should be happening, it's probably because they've surrounded themselves with yes men.
With
yes men.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Must be a right decision.
That's what I. I guess that's, the work world and stuff where you just.
What's like another way to
making ridiculous decisions and everybody agreeing with them because you have to agree because otherwise you're going to get canned. So everybody does, and then behind their back they're going, oh my.
Well, think about that woman. A synchronicity brings with it a lot of work. She's got to now write. She's got to work on her fear of public speaking. She's got to apply to a conference. If she's having a synchronicity every day, she wouldn't have time to do them all. So that's why I think they are relatively rare. And when they're real, they demand something of you.
So if it's not demanding anything of you, it's not a real synchronicity.
That might be a way to put it. Yeah.
Does she say at some point that they don't really happen until, like, all else has failed?
She does. Yeah, that's coming up. I question that paragraph. We can look at
it. I kind of wondered about that.
Yeah. Well, let me see. Where do we go? 190. I think we've done that okay. As I say, a lot of this we've already touched on. She talked about, remember the guy in the stairs, getting shot, running up the stairs? She talks about that. As if, she calls that a synchronicity. Meaning that it doesn't have to be synchronous in time. When the distinguishing characteristic is an inner image and an outer event coincide. And the outer event apparently can be much later than the inner image. And
could it be earlier too, like a retro synchronicity?
I think it could, yeah. It's harder there because you're always tempted to say one causes the other. I remember when we started doing that Nietzsche stuff. I was looking through my dreams. I don't know whether that's a synchronicity or not. I was looking through my dreams 20 years ago, and I dreamt of leading a seminar on Nietzsche. Nietzsche wasn't in my mind then. So you could say, well, that was precognitive or synchronistic. I don't know. At certain points, it gets hard to distinguish.
I just wonder if, there are different types of synchronicities. So the example you gave the woman, that's going to change the course of her life. It demands something of you. Perhaps there are others that like dreams. If they're similar to dreams, then that we just get a little teeny bit of information or a little bit of guidance or nudging in this direction. And then maybe at other times there are those huge synchronicities where now this woman has responsibility to change the course of her life. So, I don't know.
I think so. Certainly, I think I've seen ones where people are taking the steps and the synchronicity affirms what they're doing. That I can say. And too, apropos, they occur all the time. They certainly occur more when you're working with your dreams, because if you don't know your inner image, how do you know there's a synchronicity?
And
so
I wonder, like in the I Ching or any of those divinatory practices, you have to be stirred up inside. You have to be struggling with a conflict or something before that outer thing can be activated.
Indeed.
So for happy carrots, do they have... or just...
I think they tend to belittle them. We're almost done, but shall we have a stretch, and then we'll finish little munchies, and then we'll finish in about 5 or 10 minutes, then we'll have show and tell.